Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion, titled Religious Practices and the Formation of Subjects. Our speaker is Kevin Schilbrack, professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Appalachian State University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director, David Eckel.
Our guest today is Kevin Schilbrack, who comes to us from Appalachian State University, where he is professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion. He works at the intersection of philosophy and religious studies and is the author of an extremely influential book in this field called Philosophy and the Study of Religion, A Manifesto. He will be speaking to us this afternoon on the topic of religious practices and the formation of subjects. After Professor Schilbrack's talk, there will be responses by Elizabeth Pritchard from Bowdoin College and Thomas or Tal Lewis from Brown University. Tal Lewis also has written an important new book on the relationship between philosophy and religious studies, whose title is Why Philosophy Matters for the Study of Religion and Vice Versa. So please join me in welcoming all three of our speakers to Boston and to the Institute for Philosophy and Religion.
Hi, everybody. I'm thrilled to be here and flattered to be here. What does it mean to say that an action is a kind of a text? In a series of essays written in the 1970s, Paul Ricoeur proposed that to see an action as a kind of a text requires one to take the event of a human action as it appears and disappears in time and to objectify or fix it in such a way as to identify in the action the structure of a locutionary act. That is, you see the action as someone communicating something to somebody. One can identify the propositional content of the action. Ricoeur, following Husserl, calls it the noema. So you can figure out what's she trying to say to me when she does the action. And you can abstract from the bodily movements and the gestures that communicate it. And this kind of objection is required if we're going to talk about the action as meaningful. On this hermeneutic approach, a text becomes a good paradigm for the object of the social sciences, and the interpretation of text becomes a good paradigm for the method of the social sciences. So Paul Ricoeur is like other 1960s and 1970s philosophers of the social sciences who wanted to oppose the positivistic and behavioristic accounts of action that didn't include the meanings of the action. And this group of people, Charles Taylor and Peter Winch and Ricoeur and others, they champion an interpretive social science. So Clifford Geertz embraces this hermeneutic approach, and he acknowledges, I'm borrowing all this from Ricoeur, he says at the beginning of his collection of essays, and he uses it to argue for a symbolic conception, not only of individual actions, but more broadly for a semiotic conception of culture as a whole. One can interpret an individual action as a text communicating a piece of local knowledge. For example, a person, this is Geertz's famous example, who winks at another person. They're communicating something according to a socially established code in our culture. If somebody makes fun of somebody else who's winking by parodying the wink, they're doing the same thing. They're still communicating something. The codes provide those who participate in the practice with a vocabulary of gestures with which to say something about their circumstances. You can say something like, I'm not being serious, or that guy is ridiculous, with your wink. And then Geertz says you can interpret a culture as a whole, as an assemblage of texts like this. Here's a quote. Doing ethnography is like trying to read a manuscript that has been written in shaped behavior. So this hermeneutic approach seeks to uncover what practices communicate. The working hypothesis is that when participants engage in a communal event to pursue some particular end, like a funeral where they're disposing of a corpse, or a cockfight, as Geertz's famous case, where they're gambling over which rooster is going to win, they do the action in a way that says something about themselves. The practices that one does and the style with which one does them provides a vehicle by which the participants IM each other about what they're thinking, about what's going on. It's not wrong to say about Clifford Geertz that all human beings seek meaning. He's looking for the meaning of their practices. They're trying to create lives for themselves that make sense to themselves, says Geertz. But it's still important to see that when Geertz reads a wink or a funeral or an installation ritual or a dress code or a march, he doesn't claim that the participants want to say something about meaning or that they want to say something about a meaningful life in the abstract. But what they're probably saying in their march is something about their nation or about violence or about identity. Now I've got Colin Kaepernick in my mind, right? When the person does a gesture, they are communicating a meaning, which we can read, but the way they do it could be, I'm supporting her when this thing happens, or I'm commenting on that. I'm sorry, I have a long list of all the things Geertz says that they might be saying. Legitimacy, revolution, ethnicity, urbanization, status, death, or time. Not meaning, right? They're not just talking about meaning. And then the particular practices that Geertz labels the religious practices are the ones that take violence or one's status or one's nation, and they put it into a metaphysical framework. The practices that teach our social order is not just a human creation, but it's part of the very nature of things, those are the ones that Geertz says, well, that's a religious practice then. Some of the messages coded in practices are conscious and explicit. Certainly the people who use a wink to flirt know the code that they're drawing on. But Geertz provides for the possibility that performers tacitly communicate even more than they recognize. A practice might have latent or unconscious messages. For example, Geertz notes that the men who bring their roosters to the cockfight, there's lots of jokes about the name of the bird. In Geertz's article, he refers to it. And the people who bet on them may communicate a message about male narcissism or status rivalry or the nature of sacrifice that the people who are participating, they never themselves thought about, and they might not be able to articulate it if you ask them. So therefore, the student of a religious practice, who's the observer, who Geertz says they read over the shoulders onto the text that is being written by the native informant, their job is not only to faithfully capture what the participants think they're doing. Interpreters of human practices can also uncover meanings of which the participants are unaware, or meanings that they might even deny if you confronted them with it. So the hermeneutic approach, I'm still on stage one, right? The hermeneutic approach to the study of religious practices doesn't impede us from analyzing a practice in terms of its latent psychological or social functions. Now, stage two, critics of the hermeneutic approach to the study of religious practices complain that this focus on hidden meanings and decoding symbols, they complain that it focuses on that, and they complain that it's blind to what the practice actually does to the participants. For Foucault, the hermeneutic approach, like its sisters, existentialism and phenomenology, it assumes a naive, humanistic philosophy of the subject, according to which the forms of social life, the institutions that we're a part of, the practices that we do, the roles that we inherit, they're simply the product of outpouring of human concepts into the world. So the naive view is, well, why do we have an institution like BU? Oh, somebody wanted it. So they said, let's make it. And it's just human beings have these ideas, and they outpour their ideas out into the world, and they create these institutions. What's distinctive about Foucault's approach is that, here's a quote from Foucault, it reverses the course of energy and the power that might result from it, and it turns it into a relation of strict subjection. That's to say, the practices, roles, and institutions of our social environments, they produce human subjects, not the reverse. So for Foucault, a social practice is best understood. Don't use the metaphor of a text the way that Ricoeur and Geertz did. Use the metaphor of a tool or a device or an apparatus. It's doing something to people. It's making them into being the people with the identities that they have. So this idea that's key to the genealogical approach is that subjects are produced by and they're the effect of historically specific social forces. And Foucault details how through the control of space via enclosure and partitioning and functional sites and ranking and interchangeability, those are all the subsections in discipline and punish, and through the control of time, through timetables and programs and the correlation of body gesture and object with particular objects, through those strategies, modern hospitals, armies, schools, factories, together we're able to make human beings docile and more useful. And the routines in these institutions instill in people different identities and self-understandings and desires, in short, different subjectivities. Social power does this work regardless of the conscious or unconscious intentions of the subjects who are disciplined and constituted by it. Foucault calls this process of subjecting people to social forces while simultaneously constituting them as subjects, subjection. Perhaps the foremost proponent of Foucault's genealogical approach in the study of religion is Talal Asad, and Asad argues that scholars distort religious practices, and they certainly distort monastic disciplines, when they assume that the practices are performed in order to send a message. It's more accurate instead to see religious rituals, ceremonies, spiritual disciplines as training the participants, inculcating in them the behaviors that have been authorized as proper. One should therefore set aside the idea that rituals are a form of coded communication. Set that aside, Asad says, and see them instead as skilled performances. When one person prostrates in front of another or is made to prostrate in front of somebody else, one doesn't say something in a coded way about submission. One is submitting. That's Foucault and Asad's point. In this way, the genealogical approach enables a person to, quote, conceptualize human behavior in terms of learned capacities and to analyze the body as an assemblage of embodied attitudes, not as a medium of symbolic meanings. That's a diss of the hermeneutic approach. So Asad explicitly critiques Geertz's dispositional language of moods and motivations. And in their place, he adopts Foucault's language that society inscribes its sign onto the body. Here, the study of religious practices shifts from the search for meanings that are private to, quote-unquote, bodily marks that are public. And it's absolutely true that one's learned modes of comportment, one's gender, the language one speaks, one's style of clothes, all of this, as Foucault says, can emit signs to other people. I'm single. I'm funny. I'm athletic, or whatever the message is that it's sending, in a way that's not conscious to the person who's doing it. They don't know, may not know what effect they're having on other people. So genealogy seeks, therefore, to uncover what hermeneutics has not seen, that is, the idea central to the hermeneutic approach, that religious practices teach moods and motivations, actually presupposes the concrete arrangement of social power in practices, roles, and institutions that genealogy studies. As Asad says, it's not symbols that implant religious beliefs. Though religious practices might use symbols to say something, a given teaching is only going to be persuasive in a discursive and social context in which that teaching could be received as plausible. And because Geertz doesn't analyze social power, this is a quote, he postulates the function of rituals in generating religious conviction, but how or why this happens is nowhere explained. So the genealogical approach's focus on social discipline, by contrast, gets at the material conditions under which religious teachings are possible. Unlike hermeneutics, then, genealogy gets at how religious practices actually work. All right, so that's the end of my first section. That's the sketch of position one and position two and why they're in tension with each other. My next section is called Reconciling the Hermeneutic and Genealogical Approaches. So I judge that, properly understood, the hermeneutics and genealogical approaches complement each other. The primary philosophical stumbling block to reconciling them is a disagreement about the notion of subjectivity, this notion that human beings have the causal capacities of perception and understanding and volition so that they can be the efficient causes of their own actions. Let's call an approach that includes subjects like this who have those perceptive and understanding and volitional capacities a humanist approach. Many people have assumed that one has to choose between Geertz's hermeneutical approach as a humanist study of private hidden meanings and Asad's genealogical approach as a post-humanist study of public visible forces. The difference is often framed as a choice between studying what's quote-unquote internal and what's quote-unquote external. Geertz does the internal stuff and Asad does the external stuff. Asad himself sometimes describes the difference between their approaches in this way, and that's the way he's read by people, and I just came across an introduction to the study of religion that had that in the first chapter. But this frame, I think, is misguided. The hermeneutical and the genealogical approaches are reconcilable because the claim that Geertz and Asad disagree about subjectivity is confused, and it's confused on two basic ideas. Here's the first one. First, Geertz does not locate meaning in an inner or private realm. Geertz fully assimilated the Wittgensteinian view in which meaning is intersubjective and social. In fact, the non-privacy of meaning is probably Geertz's foremost theoretical contribution to anthropology. and he is therefore adamant that what a symbol means is not subjective, not interior, not in your head. Those are all quotes. Clifford Geertz's slogan is that culture is public because meaning is public, and he rejects the privatist interpretation of meaning explicitly and repeatedly. Though Assad criticizes Geertz for adopting a privatist understanding of religion that makes the category of belief central, the truth is that Geertz's famous multi-part definition of religion never mentions belief at all. Instead, Geertz makes social practices central to the creation of religious commitments. Here's a quote. "It is in ritual, that is, consecrated behavior, that the conviction that religious conceptions are veridical and that religious directives are sound is somehow generated." The argument that Geertz focuses on religions as private beliefs is a complete misreading. The second error is to assume that the genealogical approach dispenses with the subject, that is, that it's a post-humanist philosophy. It's true that the genealogical approach critiques the notion of an autonomous subject, the idea that people just want what they want or think what they think or just choose what they choose independent of their social location or the operations of social power. The genealogical approach historicizes the subject. Nobody has desires or thoughts or makes choices free of their particular historical context. This critique of subjectivity is altogether sound, but the consequences of the genealogical critique have been read in two different ways. On the one hand, some take the genealogical method, and I'm quoting from Foucault, to dispense with the subject or get rid of the subject. And on this post-humanist interpretation, genealogy leads to the view that human subjects do not constitute themselves just through their own volition, but they're constituted by non-intentional forces. Here, human desires and thoughts and choices are nothing but the echo of social forces. Foucault suggests this interpretation when Foucault speaks of human beings as machines or automata or objects. Here, people are the products and not the producers of social identities and roles and institutions. Disciplinary power, not individual choice, explains people's identity. You might call this an either-or position, and it's a radical post-structuralist position. On this radical interpretation, genealogy holds that people lack the causal capacities of perception, understanding, and volition so that they can be the efficient causes of their own actions. That's one interpretation of what Foucault's up to and what Assad's up to. Here's the other one. Some take the genealogical critique of the autonomous subject to mean that subjectivity is always conditioned and constrained by material forces. Human thinking, desiring, and willing never float free of the influence of social power. On this humanist interpretation, there's no non-material cogito, and there's no non-historical transcendental ego, but there continues to be agency, decision, and will shaped by the social context. We could call this a both-and position, a moderate post-structuralism. If one embraces the radical interpretation of genealogy, one ends up with a rejection of the subject and a post-humanism. If one takes the moderate interpretation, then one ends up with a revised philosophy of the subject and a materialist humanism. Foucault is long protested when he's read as denying the existence of the subject or replacing it with social power. I've got a good juicy footnote if you need it. Though he insists that human subjectivity is shaped by social forces, that's what I called moderate post-structuralism, he doesn't reduce, collapse, or replace what a person thinks with social structures. For Foucault, subjectivity is not separate from social structures, but one can nevertheless speak of it as a reality that's distinct from them. As Foucault writes in this both-and vein, the way a person thinks is related to society, politics, economics, and history, and it's also related to the very general and universal categories and formal structures, but thought is something other than societal relations. This is precisely what I've called the moderate view, the way we ought to read genealogy. Some people have treated Foucault's concept of subjection as referring to the actual creation of subjectivity. But genealogy seeks to uncover how a subject is constituted, quote-unquote, that is, how a subject comes to have the particular character that it has, and not about how subjectivity is created out of nothing. As Foucault writes, "My problem was not defining the moment from which something like the subject appeared." Throughout his career, Foucault assumes the reality of subjects. With the concept of subjection, he seeks to provide a single concept that captures how agents are simultaneously objects and subjects, both acted upon and active, both produced by and productive of social structures. That's the way Judith Butler reads him, and that's the way I read him. Given the genealogical approach, subjects are not autonomous, but rather necessarily constrained. On this approach, Foucault describes persons as automata or objects, not to deny that they are also active conscious subjects, but just to underline that they are also acted upon, and so they come to behave in automatic ways or non-intentional ways, which is true. So one sees this same critique of subjectivity rather than the elimination of subjectivity in Assad's work on religious practices. It's illuminating to pay attention to Assad's discussion of the concept of dispositions. Dispositions are tendencies to act or think or feel in a specific way. And as noted above when I was talking about Geertz, the idea of dispositions is central to Geertz's project. He talks about moods and motivations, and those are dispositions. In his critique of Geertz, which is the chapter in the book Genealogies of Religion that I mentioned before, Assad highlights Geertz's talk of moods and motivations as subjective, interior, and implicitly Christian. In place of internal dispositions, Assad borrows from Foucault the language of marking or inscribing the body as if the effects of disciplinary practices are external or visible. But religious practices rarely involve literal tattoos. So readers should keep in mind that the idea of marks on the body is metaphorical. Training a person to act in one way rather than another, to see the world in one way rather than another, to feel one way rather than another, is precisely to lead them to have certain dispositions. One simply cannot make sense of Foucault and Assad's focus on disciplinary power without the subjectivist or mentalist concept of dispositions. And this concept is equally central to Pierre Bourdieu's concept of habitus and Asaba Mahmoud's concept of ethical formation. All these genealogical social forces theorists, they have to have a word for how the individual person appropriates what the social forces are putting on them. And almost all of them use this word dispositions. So even though at one point in his career, Assad mocks Geertz, he's like, oh, you think there's dispositions going on in somebody's head. The more you read him, the more you're going to find that same language in Assad. So the genealogical approach historicizes the subject, and so it drops the notion that human beings are constituted by the same dispositions at all times and places. Human subjects are the product of their times and places in that what they take as beautiful or just or reasonable and so on will vary according to the discursive and institutional apparatuses by which the person was shaped. But for Assad, as for Foucault, genealogy does not drop the notion that human beings are subjects of experiences, desiring agents who have wills and make judgments. On the issue of whether human behavior is caused by social structure or subjectivity, I agree that Foucault and Assad's positions are both and humanist positions and not anti-humanist ones. I take it that Assad has come to recognize this, and this is why in his more recent essays of language marking the body, the language of marking the body is hard to find, but the language of inculcating or cultivating dispositions continues to pervade his analysis of religious practices. Assad's recent work is full of the subjectivist language of emotions and experiences and sensibilities and dispositions, and this is altogether apt since genealogy doesn't eliminate the subject. It's therefore not surprising that Assad also doesn't seek to eliminate from the study of religious practices the subjective aspects of belief or moods or motivations. The categories of belief and experience cannot be eliminated from the study of human agency, chapter 5 of the book. And Assad has recently agreed with this in 2012, even though that 1993 book gets cited as an anti-humanist. In sum, on this section 2, my argument is that since Geertz and Ricoeur locate meaning not in a private or subjective realm, but rather in a public and an intersubjective realm that includes non-intentional forces, and since Foucault and Assad do not reject the notion of subjectivity, but rather insist on its importance, hermeneutics and genealogy can be seen as complementary approaches to a common topic, namely the relation of religious practices to the formation of subjectivity. On this shared topic, Geertz's hermeneutic approach foregrounds the intentional aspects of human agency, even while affirming the subjectivity is always formed by social practices, and Assad's genealogical approach foregrounds the non-intentional aspects of human agency, even while affirming that people both act and are acted upon. Okay, so here's my third and last chapter of the paper, the embodiment approach. So this was the third of my three, if I was successful in reconciling one and two. So I have this third approach to the study of religious practices, what Thomas Sordas calls the embodiment paradigm. Sordis's argument, which I want to champion and argue for, is that what the theorizing of human behavior has overlooked is embodiment, which he means the pre-reflective, but not pre-cultural, modes of perception and engagement with one's environment. It's crucial that we have a clear view of the aspect of human culture that Sordis claims that we've missed. What the embodiment paradigm brings to the theorization of social practices isn't the body. The body was already being theorized, either by Geertz in hermeneutics as a bearer of messages, or in genealogy as the site of cultural inscription. Drawing on the existential phenomenology of Merleau-Ponty, however, Sordis distinguishes between the body understood in one of those two ways, as the site of representation, on the one hand, and the body understood on the other hand, as the seat of subjectivity, as the what you're alive, feeling, and doing immediately right now, the existential ground of culture and self. So, as we saw before, Geertz's approach to the study of embodied practices treats the body as a text. The religious body in a ritual symbolizes or represents a meaning. And it's not only the hermeneutic approach that treats religious practices as a kind of writing that you can read. When Foucault and Assad speak of inscriptions of culture on the body or marking the body with signs, they're moving within that same textualist or representationalist metaphor. Sordis notes that the model of a text is especially appealing to those who are not engaged in work, not engaged in practice, or perhaps those whose primary practice is reading. He means academics. They're the ones who say, this makes sense to me that a wink is a text, and a dance is a text, and sex is a text, and so on. Sordis says the text, quote unquote, is a hungry metaphor. It's so hungry that it threatens to swallow all of culture to the point where it became possible and even convincing to hear the deconstructionist motto that there's nothing outside the text. So what Merleau-Ponty and other phenomenological philosophers help us retrieve, by contrast, are the bodily processes of perception and engaged being in the world by which those representations originally come into being. What Sordis is calling for, therefore, is not the repudiation of the hermeneutic idea that a practice communicates according to local codes and can therefore be read, nor the genealogical idea that a practice shapes the participants in ways that don't depend on their intentions. The addition of this embodiment approach creates instead a synthetic proposal in which one sees a ritual body both as the product of culture and as an existential reality in its own right, both as a system of representation and as a lived experience, both as an object and as a subject. Sordis is explicit that the embodiment paradigm adds a complement to and doesn't repudiate the ritual as text metaphor. But if we can add the embodiment approach to the others, then we end up with a model that includes three approaches to the study of religious practices, each seeking to grasp one aspect. The hermeneutic approach seeks to grasp what a practice says, the genealogical approach seeks to grasp what a practice does to the participants, and the embodiment approach seeks to grasp the subjective experience of the participants. So up to this point, my paper sought to present these three approaches in a complementary way that shows that they can be compatible. On this account, the pursuit of one doesn't undermine or incapacitate the pursuit of the others. But in closing, I want to make the stronger argument that all three are indispensable in the sense that those who pursue any one approach should insist that it implies the work of the others. I expect that one doesn't have to make this indispensability argument for hermeneutics or for genealogy. Attention to meanings and to social power is fairly well established in the field. The skepticism arises about including the category of subjective experience. I mean, this is probably the biggest, most controversial part of this paper. Is I'm like, I want to know how the person feels when they do the action. I want to know what it means to them. And so I want to know what is the experience that they have, not just what do I observe when I see their body doing the action. So when one studies religions with a model of subjectivity according to which social events are public and perceptions and desires and judgments are private, then the very notion of studying subjective experience is rendered problematic. If you have kind of an inside-outside model of what a human being is, I don't know what that person's thinking. I only know what they're doing. If you've got that kind of a model, with that model arises the problem of access. How do I get inside another person's head to determine what she's thinking, or even whether she's thinking? Right? All these modern Cartesian philosophers that say, you never know what goes on in another person's head, then they quickly get to a kind of skepticism where they say, and I don't know that they're not zombies or robots. Like, how do I know that they have any feelings or thoughts? It's a great question, but I think it presupposes this dualistic model. I judge that there are many scholars in our field in religious studies who assume a model of subjectivity like this, and this is what leads them to argue that scholars of religion should drop the category of belief, or they should drop the category of experience. But this model of subjectivity reflects a dichotomized Cartesian way of seeing the mind, and there's been at least a century of work in philosophy by pragmatists, ordinary language philosophers, existentialists, and feminists, disassembling it and of seeing subjectivity as social, discursive, and historically located. Merleau-Ponty's existential phenomenology and Sordis's cultural phenomenology are part of this post-Cartesian movement. So, what is the contribution of this embodiment approach? What does it mean to include in the study of religious practices the pre-reflective perceptual experiences and actions of embodied and engaged agents? I think that one concept that is promising is the idea of affordances. Affordances is a term introduced by the psychologist James Gibson to name the properties of physical objects insofar as they invite or solicit a specific use. Here's a quote. If an object that rests on the ground has a surface that is itself sufficiently rigid, level, flat, and extended, and if this surface is raised approximately at the height of the knees of the human biped, then it affords sitting on. So just imagine a tired person, she's been hiking or whatever, and there's a log or there's a stone, and it's about that right height. She might not think to herself, that reminds me of a chair. She might not have to reflect on it and go, that has the properties that I could sit on it. She just sits, right? It calls out. She immediately sees it permits, I like this word, it solicits that kind of engagement. As one can see with this example, affordances are objective properties in one's environment, although they exist as affordances only relative to the properties and interests of some perceiving and acting agent. Gibson spoke of affordances in the physical world, but to adapt this concept for the study of religious practices, we should notice that not just physical objects, but anything at all with which people interact, including the movements of other people, emotions, laws, light and darkness, smells, all of these things can be taken by a perceiving agent to provide an opportunity for action. I take it as a working hypothesis that religious practices often include experiences in which people come to perceive their lives as opportunities for action. What I should do, what I should not do, the full range of religiously normed perception and action comes through in a religious practice. What is it to be blessed, to feel like something is blessed? What is it to feel like something is abominable? What is it to be enlightened? What is it to be attached? The experience of those things comes through in religious practices. And I think we can call them ritual affordances in the sense that one's engagement with other people, with the light and the darkness of the room, with the candles, with the smells, with the emotions that the person's feeling, with their perceptions, provide opportunities for them to think, this is abominable. I don't want to act like this. So if we can include this embodied perspective, then the study of religious practices includes the study of normed perceptual experience. To be sure, the ritual participants themselves may not be able to articulate these norms, but this is just because reflexivity and reason-giving is not a condition of living a religious life, just as it is not a condition for living an ethical life. Thus, the problem involved in the study of embodied experiences is not that they are private or inaccessible, but rather that they are part of our taken-for-granted, tacit, and in-the-background existence. So, we don't need the category of embodiment to introduce subjectivity as a dimension in the study of religious practices. Subjectivity is already present both in the hermeneutical study of meaning and in the genealogical study of subjection. But those discussions are, to use Sordis's term, representationalist, and they tend not to include the bodily processes of perception and engaged being in the world, which first bring those representations into being within the person, and then second, weave them into the person's identity. If one does not also include this category of embodied experience, then one studies subjects only in the subjected sense of textual objects and social constructions. This is the dimension of practice that Foucault called automata and objects and robots and machines, and it exists, but it's not the whole of what a person is. Thank you guys for your attention.
Thanks very much, Kevin. That was just great. Lots of things for us to think about and to help us think about them. We have two respondents. We have Professor Lewis from Brown and Professor Pritchard from Bowdoin. And while you're catching your breath, Professor Pritchard, why don't we ask Tal if he'd like to speak for a bit? Should we do that? And then when Tal's finished, why don't you grab the microphone and lead us off in another wonderful direction?
Professor Shilbrack's talk, Religious Practices and the Formation of Subjects, participates in a broader current of attention to practice in the study of religion. Spurred by the work of figures such as Pierre Bourdieu, Michel Foucault, Judith Butler, Talal Asad, and others, many scholars in religion, in a variety of subfields, have argued adamantly that we must move beyond the study of beliefs and of texts to the study of practice, religious and otherwise. Of course, this turn to practice, and even the notion of practice itself, have been understood in very different ways, but the term practice has often served as an umbrella category for a loosely allied conglomeration of developments. In the years since the publication of Talal Asad's Genealogies of Religion in 1993, this turn to practice has frequently appeared to be the driving, perhaps dominant, current in religious studies, though much of that may depend on where you happen to be studying religion. Kevin's paper, like his important recent book, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, A Manifesto, both appreciates this development and resists the idea that it renders previously pervasive developments in the field obsolete. We can and should attend to practices and to power more than we often have, yet we should not be abandoning meaning. We need meaning both because the study of religion need not be reduced to the study of religious practice, and because the study of practice requires attention to meaning. Asad has not slain Geertz. We can and should have them both, and one of the keys to having them both will be philosophically precise analysis of the conceptions of subjectivity and practice operating in the relevant projects. At times, it will require curbing rhetorical excess. At other moments, it will require pushing for greater coherence than yet exists in the texts. And I think here of Shilbrack's critique of Asad's original critique of Geertz. In these points as well, Shilbrack participates in a broader current. My colleague, Stephen Bush, in his book from 2014, Visions of Religion, Experience, Meaning, and Power, has argued that the study of religion in the 20th and 21st centuries has been serially dominated by three successive paradigms: experience, meaning, and power. William James, Clifford Geertz, and Talal Asad function as the representative figures, though Bush does not reduce the paradigms to these individuals. While defenders of each paradigm have generally taken their paradigm to supplant its predecessors, Bush argued that we need all three. As Bush wrote, quote, "Meaning, power, and experience are all essential categories for religious studies, and they are, as Geertz puts it, mutually implicative. A commitment to any one of these terms entails the other two. The three are not only all essential, they require each other," much as Shilbrack contends toward the end of the talk. So, where Bush organizes his analysis in terms of experience, meaning, and power, Professor Shilbrack sets out meaning, power, and embodiment. His use of the third term draws on the work of Thomas Sordas and Sordas's use of Merleau-Ponty. I would like to get a more precise picture of the distinctive contributions that you see this approach making. And in many ways, my comments are oriented toward asking for more elaboration of the final few minutes of the talk, since there is so much interesting work being done there. And perhaps we might focus particularly on the issues of hearing more about why you see this conception of embodiment as sufficiently distinct so as to constitute an alternative approach, not just a further articulation of the kind of attention to the body that is generated in figures such as Foucault and Asad. And I'd also be curious to hear more about whether you're presenting this as an alternative to the account of experience that Bush offers. In closing, though, let me turn to a broader issue. A number of my comments have involved questioning whether the conception of embodiment that Professor Schilbrack is championing constitutes a distinct approach, or rather a way of filling out our account of a number of the issues that were already on the table, such as further specification, perhaps maybe even a competing specification of the notion of dispositions. At a certain point, however, the question, but is this really a different approach, starts to become tedious, and we ought to be asking what is at stake in that question itself. What's the difference between trying to bring together purported approaches or modes of studying religion rather than simply trying to develop the most compelling and coherent position that we can by drawing on a range of theorists whom we find helpful? More pointedly, would we be better off if we stopped asking whether it is a genuinely different approach? I want to defend two answers to this question, yes and no. I am, after all, a kind of Hegelian. I'll start with no. I don't think we need to stop asking whether the various candidates constitute distinct approaches or modifications of other approaches. We don't need to stop asking that question. Doing so can be valuable in placing in relief dominant currents in the field and organizing their contributions. Beyond this, however, by presenting particular theories as representative of competing paradigms, thinkers such as Schilbrack and Bush direct our attention to the challenges of bringing them together. They illuminate why these have been understood as competing candidates. Doing so ultimately serves the goal of probing whether and how these seemingly opposed contributions might be brought into a coherent vision that enables us to claim what it is that we find valuable in each of the different approaches. For at the end of the day, yes, there does come a time when we would be better off if we stopped asking, or at least paused in our asking, about whether various figures offer something that constitutes a fundamentally distinct approach in this sense. Ultimately, I think we seek to come up with as coherent a picture as we can, a picture that reconciles what might appear to be competing views. What matters here, when we're engaged in that goal, is our ability to render them in an account that is not at odds with itself. It may be a complex view, but it will be more compelling insofar as it does not commit us to mutually incompatible claims. Whether various perspectives that we ought to incorporate, the ingredients, we might say, of the position we seek to develop, were initially from very different approaches or perhaps minor variations on each other, doesn't matter for that task. What we will ultimately care about there is the persuasiveness of the view that emerges from the process. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tal. We'll now turn things over to Elizabeth Pritchard for your comment.
I have four large questions for Kevin this evening. Is Schilbrack's project an attempt at recouping agency? Number one. Number two, what precisely does he understand by embodiment and subjectivity? Number three, why search for the seat of subjectivity? That's a quote from his paper. And fourth, what is the connection to hope? In his talk this evening, Kevin Schilbrack seems to have accomplished all that one could hope for. He reconciles elegantly the presumed antithesis of the hermeneutical and genealogical approaches to understanding religious communities. His main contention in this regard is that the genealogical method does not, qua its critics, dissolve the subject into the various social forces said to constitute the subject, apart from the subject's intentions. The genealogical approach yields a materialist humanism whereby agency, decision, and will are thoroughly historical, but not thereby annihilated. The hermeneutical and a genealogical approaches ought then to be used in tandem so that we might decipher what practices mean and delineate what they make of practitioners. Schilbrack is not, however, satisfied. Although he acknowledges that both the hermeneutical and the genealogical approaches attend to embodiment and subjectivity, he insists that they miss something crucial about persons. Thus, he calls for the addition of a third approach, which he refers to as the embodiment paradigm. Schilbrack glosses the difference between these three approaches as follows. With regards to an action, the hermeneutic approach asks, what does the practice say? The genealogical approach asks, what does it do to participants? Schilbrack does not actually specify the question to which the embodiment paradigm is directed. He writes that embodiment paradigm, quote, seeks to grasp the subjective experience of the participants. What is the coincident question? Is it, what does the practice feel like? Which I think you suggested in your talk tonight. Or perhaps it would be, what does the body know in executing the practice? Schulbrach insists that the body is creative in its pre-reflectivity, that it is not only a text that can be read and not only the product of social power. My sense is, then, that Schulbrach's turn to the embodiment paradigm reflects his desire to recoup or perhaps ground the agency of religious practitioners. One might say that Schulbrach's project is the flip side to that of Donovan Schaefer, whose project Schulbrach cites. For Schaefer, sustained attention to extra-linguistic embodiment, especially in his case, especially affect theory, is crucial if we wish to thoroughly map the circuits of power. For as he insists, language is not the only medium of power. Whereas Schaefer's delineation of the ambient forces surrounding and penetrating persons relativizes human subjectivity, Schulbrach's valorization of the embodiment paradigm heralds instead, quote, the perceiving, problem-solving person. I am not convinced, however, that the embodiment paradigm, at least as Schulbrach sketches it here tonight, makes a significant contribution to the hermeneutic and genealogical approaches, and I'll consider this with regard to the question of human agency. Schulbrach draws on Lawrence Shapiro's review of the cognitive science research paradigm entitled Embodied Cognition. As Shapiro notes on more than one occasion, among these scientists, there is, quote, no consensus about how to understand embodiment. I take this to be a highly significant qualification. Moreover, I feel compelled to pose it as a question to Schulbrach. How do you understand embodiment? It seems clear that for Schulbrach, embodiment includes perception. Such perceptions are, moreover, anatomically driven and historically loaded. Yet Schulbrach also refers to the ritual body, quote, as an existential reality in its own right. What does he mean by this? Moreover, what is meant by the slippages between bodies, subjects, and persons? Schulbrach declares, for instance, that ritual bodies are also active subjects. Schulbrach expressly repudiates a Cartesian dualism of mind and body, but I would like to know what Schulbrach understands by embodiment and subjectivity. My sense is that Schulbrach is looking to recoup agency as a property of subjects that reflects an irreducible residue of subjectivity. For Schulbrach finds in the embodiment paradigm grounds for a rediscovery of what he refers to as the whole of what a subject is, and for the body as the, quote, seat of subjectivity, the existential ground of culture and self. He writes, these experiences of perception and judgment involve looking for and making use of physical, social, and ethical affordances, that is, opportunities for practical action in one's immediate environment. None of these embodied cognitive judgments are free from the structure of social power. I'm still quoting him. But the point is that embodiment names a dimension of creative problem solving that is part of social practices. Despite the constitution of experience by discourse, the body in a religious practice is not only a text that one can read and not only the product of social power, but also a perceiving, problem-solving person. This passage suggests that Schulbrach is gesturing towards something that is apart from or reducible to social practices and power. Thus, the notion of agency, which is implied here, evokes a deep-seated, pre-reflective existentialism of the subject that indicates, for Schulbrach, that the subject is more than automata or more than a text and a product. Moreover, Schulbrach describes the individual as one who is, quote, experiencing perceptions and judgments rather than simply perceiving and judging. He also refers to the embodiment paradigm as seeking to grasp subjective experience. Is Schulbrach describing consciousness? If so, Schulbrach risks conflating what Talal Asad has rightly, in my view, insisted be distinguished, subjecthood and agency. Asad argues that whereas the subject is founded on consciousness of self, agency has to do with access to resources, discursive and material, and the antecedent and resultant actions by which persons make history. Schulbrach might counter that he is not negating these dimensions, and indeed takes note of them in referring to social practices. Rather, he is insisting that these dimensions are supplemented by or dependent upon pre-reflective circuits that indicate the worldliness of bodies. At the same time, he suggests that the hermeneutical and genealogical methods miss something about religious practitioner, practitioners, and thus recommends that scholars look to an indeterminate region of existential embodiment for evidence of the more that constitutes human subjects. Yet I fear that such a move distracts from, or perhaps compensates for, the material conditions that make for profound inequities of agency. Here again, I'm in agreement with Talal Asad, who in discussing agency points toward, quote, the politically more significant condition that has to do with the objective distribution of goods that allows for or precludes certain options. My final question is, what does Shilbrack's inquiry have to do with hope? Which is, to say that humans are always already perceiving problem-solving persons seems like the surest reason for hope. Shilbrack's microanalytic framing is bound to discover sensations, impulses, reactions, and accidents that resemble the projective and purposeful movements we have long associated with agents. At the same time, such analyses risk missing or even obscuring the larger structures, the patterns, the conditions that make evident the always relative and never whole character of creativity, problem solving, and access to affordances. I have in mind here the strategy utilized by the police officer's defense team in the Rodney King beating from the early 90s. If we zoom in, slow down, and isolate each discrete action, including a position, a gesture, a glance, we will see the irrefutable minutiae of human agency. Though Shilbrack is looking to complement and not replace the hermeneutic and genealogical approaches, I worry that the embodiment paradigm may upstage them in light of our stubborn attachment to the idea of a core or seat of subjectivity. But perhaps he is right to turn our attention to this attachment. Berlant warns that optimism can be cruel in a context in which shared fantasies of the good life. But perhaps Shilbrack's search for hidden sources of the, quote, whole of what a subject is exactly necessary amidst the attrition of the subject and, quote, the vampirism of profit extraction that exhausts the body. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Kevin Shilbrack, professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Appalachian State University. Professor Shilbrack's lecture was titled Religious Practices and the Formation of Subjects and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. We also heard responses tonight from Brown University professor Thomas Lewis and Bowdoin College professor Elizabeth Pritchard. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jeff Turton. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leidodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.